Speaking of intros, hello, my friend. Very good to have you on the show. Would you maybe like to give an introduction of yourself and your work to folks who might be hearing of you for the first time?
So my name is Clau O'Brien Moscoso. I'm a member of the Black Alliance for Peace in the Haiti Americas team, and I write for Black Agenda Report, specifically on the uprising in Peru that has been going on for the past almost 7 months now, since the parliamentary coup against Pedro Castillo. But yeah, thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you so much for coming on. Sorry, I was muted. I really enjoyed a lot of the things that I've been seeing from yourself, not only in the listserv with the Solidarity Network, which folks should join and check out and learn more about the Black Alliance for Peace and the different committees like the Haiti and the Americas team. I also, like you mentioned, have been following some of your work on Peru. And after learning a little bit myself during the early campaigning of Pedro Castillo about some of his, general objectives, and also watching the catastrophe that was the left's analysis here in the West of Castillo and the movements happening there in Peru, I really wanted to hear more about like your experiences talking there with people, and what it is that's been drawing folks into action. Because, of course, we see these coups all over the place, and we're seeing more spread all across the world, but we very rarely actually get to hear on the ground, conversations from people. So I was wondering if you could maybe talk just a little bit about your experiences and maybe what some of the folks there on the ground have been saying and doing as of late.
Well, so I was there. I landed in Peru January 3rd, the day before the general strike started, both to visit family, but I knew that this was something that was happening. The coup happened December 7th. So leading up to my visit, going back home to visit family for some time, I also wanted to make sure to be involved, help document whatever I could. And yeah, I got to meet a lot of people that were going to the marches every day. Got to see some of the organizing that was happening behind the ground. And really, what was amazing to me, especially when I went to travel to the south of Peru, is the way that people are organizing themselves. And really going, it is very much like region to region, what we would consider, block by block here. And because I think the majority of Peru, which is overwhelmingly, at least outside of Lima, overwhelmingly indigenous, rural campesinos, right? These are peasants. The way that their lives have already been, and have, this is definitely something that I heard throughout, was just that this has been a struggle for dignity and just basic resources for 500 years, right? So people on the ground have very much, they understand, the lack of dignity that they have in their lives. They understand that, everything that they do literally goes to the capital city, their lands, their resources, their labor, right? To fuel and feed a capital city that is just completely against any sort of national, any sort of sovereignty, any sort of like remotely, socialist politics or policies. And so when Castillo was elected, particularly for the Limeña, white European and mestizo of ruling elite in Peru, it was, they couldn't accept it, right? So really, a lot of the lawfare campaign really did start before he was even in the palace, right? It took about a month, I would say. I think it was the longest time that Peru had gone before the losing party actually conceded. So they, you know, the right wing, the ruling elite in the country, and obviously the like multinational US and Western corporations that are after those resources, right? Peru has, I believe, the world's second largest copper reserves next to Chile. It's next to the Lithium Triangle, which is Bolivia, Argentina, and Chile. And now in the south of Peru, in Puno, is one of the, I think a couple of years ago, was found to be one of the largest lithium reserves in the world. So this region of the world that has about 60%, if not more, of deposits of lithium in the world, you know, we've been seeing that there's both the pushback, right? The, you know, multinational corporations that are wanting those resources, but also the way that people and communities on the ground have been organizing themselves to both understand, because they see it, right? They see that their lands are being poisoned. They see that the water is not as clear as it used to be. The rates of cancer have gone up considerably in the past couple of generations. And this is directly tied to, you know, these mining companies and various different companies and corporations and, you know, resource extractive companies go and poison their homes, exploit them, the workers, right? And just take all of the riches of the country away from the country. Meanwhile, their kids are having to walk like 2 hours to get to school, you know? There's barely any infrastructure in the roads except what's connecting, you know, the mine to a major rail, you know, road, so that those things can be exported to other countries, to other parts of Peru, right? It's very much any sort of development. And that's definitely something I heard a lot on the ground, was people just understanding that this has been a colonial struggle, right? This has been going on since Europeans arrived on the continent and, you know, began extracting land and importing people to just exploit this continent at the expense of the people that have already been here. So it was really fascinating to see, you know, a bunch of people that were coming up from different regions throughout Peru into Lima, and just really seeing the contrast and the contradictions there, right? Like you could see the racism, blatant racism and classism of the, you know, the media that's owned very much by one of the, I believe it was maybe the second richest family in the country. So you have very much what you have here, you know, captured media. The press is not, you know, it's not a free press. So you saw that this campaign against not just Castillo, but after the coup, now against the protesters as terrorists, as, you know, savage Indians, and just like such a huge propaganda against them. And of course, in Peru, because of the internal struggle in the 80s and 90s against with terrorism, it's very much those same laws that happened during the Fujimori dictatorship and even prior to that still remain in the society, right? So there, and it has, I think, because of that time during the internal war with Senator Luminoso and other factions of that left, people in Peru have been so grown up to be anti-communist. It's a very anti-communist society, and so there's added significance when people were accusing, you know, these campesinos from coming in from Puno or from Cusco, you know, just immediately in the press, you would see like hordes of communists, right? And saying that Sendero Luminoso is still a thing, is still around, that these people are being funded by either illegal mining interest, even by Evo Morales, and saying that they're being armed or funded by Bolivia, to the point that actually Evo Morales is along with a couple other people and high-ranking officials are considered persona non grata in Peru now, and is not allowed to go into Peru because the coup regime has actually, you know, said that about him, and a couple other people too, AMLO in Mexico, because and maybe this is actually something that we've seen, right, that in the region, and this is what has been different from the past even couple of years, a lot of the neighboring countries that are also popular leftists, or, you know, some government that's responsive to the people, rejecting the coup, rejecting Dina Boluarte, and demanding for the liberty of Pedro Castillo, who many people, you know, on the ground want. That's one of the major demands, is the freedom and restitution of Castillo to end this political and social crisis, along with closing the Congress, because it's governed completely, or it's dominated completely by the far right, Fuerza Popular, which is the Fujimorista party, who's a former dictator during the 90s, and it's headed by his daughter, Keiko Fujimori. And that Congress, and it's not just Fuerza Popular, they also have, you know, various satellite parties, and even the center, you know, will often collaborate with them and, you know, be complicit in a lot of the, the coup and dictatorial power that they have at this point, because we've been seeing in the past several months that different facets, different institutions of state power, they now have control over. So I think a couple of weeks ago, is the Constitutional Tribunal said that it's under the legislative powers to decree whether, to rule whether a president or any ruling party is able to be impeached. So they have full power at this point. And not just that, several other things, right? Especially with the military and armed forces right now. Starting last month, June 1st, U.S. troops actually entered the country. It was 1,000 military troops, I believe, and I'm sure, you know, more. More will have come in, or will be coming in to train the armed forces in Peru. And this is an armed forces that is responsible for already well over 80 deaths. So, you know, we have to ask ourselves, what are you training them in? Like, continuing horrific human rights abuses, you know? At this point, it's been several human rights watchdogs and observers that have, you know, come out with reports saying that these are crimes against humanity. The violence that we've seen in these 7 months in the protests against Dina Boluarte and the coup regime, that there have been massacres, you know, in Juliaca, Puno. In one day, 18 people were killed. In Cusco, there were in Ayacucho, there were 15 killed. It was one of the first massacres that happened on December 15th. So these, you know, these and countless other crimes, right? There's thousands, if not more, political prisoners at this point. There's like arbitrary arrests happening. Well over 1,000, if not closer to 1,500, that have been seriously injured. Various things, right? This has been a complete state of dictatorship. And so anyone that's been going on the streets has been consistently met with violence, with rubber bullets at one point, especially in the South. And then, you know, this is something also that comes up, right? The difference in police force in Lima, in the capital city, versus how they are in the outer regions, right? Mm-hmm. So definitely the amount of deaths have been concentrated in the South, which is where a lot of the mines are. This is where, you know, the lithium deposits are in Puno. These are some of the most impoverished peoples in the country, but that sit on, you know, the wealthiest regions of the country in terms of natural resources, right? So these are the most exploited sectors of the country that have been both, like, their children have been massacred. Their spouses, their brothers, their sisters, including people that weren't even in the marches or the rallies to begin with, that, you know, one doctor that went in to try to, you know, help someone that had been injured was shot himself and killed. So these are, you know, yeah, these are grave crimes against humanity. And I think also maybe one of the reasons that the coup regime, especially Dina Boluarte, right, has just really dug in their heels, is because they know that once they come out, if there's new elections, you know, early elections, things like this, they're gonna be tried for human rights, you know, abuses, whether it's through the ICC or the Inter-American courts, of course, you know, especially the Inter-American Court of Human Rights. It's under the OAS, which is, you know, just another instrument of U.S. state power, imperial power, and who knows, right? Who knows if these are structures that would eventually bring forth some kind of accountability, right? But yeah, I think they know that they need to stay entrenched in power to not serve time. But that's definitely a lot of the things that I heard on the ground when just talking to people, interacting in the marches, but also in different, you know, planning meetings, for example, that this has been such a long struggle, and that the reason that they never let Castillo govern, but the reason being that they just didn't see not just one person that was, you know, indigenous and from a campesino background, you know, his parents were illiterate, like what they said was that they saw themselves in him, right? That they understood that what he was saying, right, was the main campaign slogan was no more poor people in a rich country, really truly spoke to them. And of course, really went against the interests of the ruling elite, local elite, and the comprador class, and of course the US and Western backed interests behind that, right? So you saw that Lisa Kenna, the US ambassador to Peru, and also former CIA agent, I believe she was one of Mike Pompeo's main advisors, that immediately met with the defense minister and had already met with Boluarte herself, basically just to, like, rubber stamp the coup, right? And say that, in fact, it was Castillo that was giving, you know, a coup, that he, you know, he made an announcement in to dissolve Congress. Of course, there was no military or police armed force behind it. So one of his defenses and what his lawyers have been putting forth as a defense is that, you know, they're trying him on rebellion and on, you know, trying to convict him on rebellion and for the coup, for launching the coup. But of course, it was just a speech that he gave. There was no actual coup behind it, right? There was no armed force behind it. So, and during his impeachment, that day on the 7th, December 7th, there was multiple things that didn't go according to what the Constitution stipulates, including that they needed to get 104 votes. They only got 101 votes. Castillo's lawyer should have been present at the time. Multiple things that didn't happen that Castillo's defense is, you know, that's what they're trying to build up the defense around, is that this, in fact, this was an illegal, what they call vacancia, which is impeachment, right? So in fact, he's still the legal president of the country. Of course, that's, you know, to be seen exactly how the coup regime will step down, but on the 19th, which is in a couple of weeks, There's going to be another mass mobilization to this, to Lima, to the city. People from around all the 25 regions of the country have been meeting in popular assemblies, both on the local level, but in regional levels and macro regional levels. There have been a lot of conversations being had, a lot of just on the ground organizing and, you know, coming to consensus around how many people they're going to send, what the platform is, a variety of things, right? But so, for example, in Puno, there's 13 regions in the department. So 1,000 people are going to be going from each region, and that's going to be the case throughout Peru, right? Different regions and different provinces have had their assemblies and are just, you know, getting together themselves and the resources to be able to continue in the struggle. So even though there have been daily actions both in Lima, but also a lot of the people that had gone to previous delegations, to previous takeovers of Lima, have gone back to their homes, right? It was the crop season. They a lot of them are campesinos, so you know they have to tend to their crops. Obviously, they have families back home, so folks who did end up going back, but continue doing actions there. There were still blockades of several major roads. So a lot of commerce wasn't going through or any kind of transportation really. Particularly on the Pan America Highway going into Brazil. So at least on the ground, there was no importing or exporting going in from Brazil from in that region. And various other things, right? People have just been mobilized since December 7th, really. So it's coming up on 7 months now, and people are, so July also is, July 28th is the independence of Peru. And that's really another reason why people wanted to pick July to be, and the end of July to be going back to Lima to actually really win their independence, you know, actually oust the coup regime and the interests that are behind this, right? People also completely understand that the U.S. has been behind this, that, you know, a lot of the mining companies that they see in their communities are Canadian mining companies or European, right? Like the oil companies, you know, in particular, Repsol is a Spanish oil company. So these are, you know, this is something that they've been seeing for centuries. And so the struggle is definitely one for their dignity and for land and for their resources to be their own and to actually go towards things like education, like healthcare, basic necessities. And especially I think for people in the south of Peru, they have been able to see Bolivia, right, being governed under a popular plurinational state and a government that they have input in, right? They've been able to see what it means like to nationalize and industrialize, you know, natural resources like lithium and have that go towards education, healthcare, basic things that people need, right? Infrastructure. So I think people, you know, have been seeing just exactly how they've been exploited and have seen a vision in a neighbor nearby, you know, and what it could potentially look like. So yeah, that is coming up in July 19th. And that's going to be the next big action, but it remains to be seen exactly how this coup regime is actually going to be toppled, what it takes. And if things like the restitution of Castillo is even, you know, how that case would move forward. But yeah, it's been very interesting to just really understand all these different factors and on the ground too.
Yo, before I even say anything, I want to say thank you so much because that was awesome. That was such a thorough walkthrough of the different kind of parts of what's going on. And of course, for folks who can't see my notes, like, it legitimately covered like the major things and questions I wanted to talk about. So that's awesome. But I did have a couple things that you brought up that I wanted to maybe take a moment to breathe on and maybe ask some follow-up on before moving to anything that I had to say. So first of all, just a simple question. Do folks on the ground know where Castillo is right now?
Yeah. So he is in the Penal de Barbadillo prison in kind of the outskirts of Lima in Ate. And it's actually the same prison where Alberto Fujimori is serving time for human rights abuses during the dictatorship, particularly for the massacre in Barrios Altos in La Cartuta. So he's, and there have actually been pretty frequent, if not daily, actions outside of La Penal, where people are, you know, just making a lot of noise and making sure that he hears them, right? And making sure that, you know, he knows that the struggle is still going on the outside.
That's beautiful that they're there and that they're able to do that for him and that there's still that solid support, you know, like you said, 7+ months in, because of course the coup happened 7 months ago, but Castillo, for folks who don't know, does come from a grassroots community organizing background. He was a teacher in the teachers union, if I'm correct, right?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yep. And of course, as you mentioned, he comes from a campesino background. He has indigenous blood. He has a family that, as you mentioned, came from illiteracy. And of course, he is someone who has lived in Peru, if he's honest with himself and opens his eyes, can see the struggles that are happening daily and have been for, as you mentioned, 500 years. So my second question was, maybe before I hit on some of the things I wanted to, maybe you would like to give folks a general concept of what some of the policies or practices that the Castillo campaign an administration had been planning or trying to put through at the time of the coup.
Yeah, so there had been a bunch of campaign proposals that he put forth and projects, proyectos de ley, as they would call it, to go through Congress, including, and more importantly, I think to a lot of people that voted for him, was agrarian reform. Which he wanted to include in that as having state ownership of lithium. That was really one of the main things, especially like I was saying before, the people in the south of Peru and Puno have been agitating towards for a long time, even before the coup, knowing that that's something that they knew, right, was going to be correctly. Would be one of the next major, you know, resources that would be extracted and basically what they called white gold, right? And so that was one of the things that he had, one of the projects of laws that he had put forward, different kinds of reforms around like media ownership, education reforms, healthcare reforms, just basic needs, right? But of course, the Congress, like I said before, that's dominated by the right wing, they really, as a lot of people would say, they didn't let him govern. Not one of his promises actually made it through, or he was able to fulfill any of his promises. At the day that he was actually ousted, that had been the third impeachment attempt. So, and I believe the first one was done maybe like a month or two after he had actually, after his administration had actually started. So they really weren't, you know, letting him, and he was, he he knew he was going to have a very uphill struggle. Of course, there's definitely also things that, you know, people on the ground had said that that's something that they wish that even before the coup happened, that he had maybe not alienated himself too much or gotten away too much from the popular movement sector. Right. So he did, there were several things that people consider maybe mistakes, right? Including, and it's something that people talk about as being one of the first signs of thinking like, oh, they're going to try to go for the coup, which is having to get rid of Héctor Béjar as foreign minister. Because he, one among one of the many things that he did was normalize relations with Venezuela, right? So of course, the right-wing Congress was, and media and the ruling elite were completely up in arms about, right? And that was one of the main things that Congress and media would use to, of course, say like, oh, he's a communist, he's trying to normalize relations with the dictatorship of Maduro. Of course, they're very anti-Venezuela, very anti-Cuba, Nicaragua, and any efforts that were made to try to normalize relations were immediately, you know, pounced on and weaponized and used against him, you know, to further delegitimize him. But so he had to change cabinets a bunch of different times in order to try to appease the center and the right at times. And yeah, people on the ground, you know, definitely saw that as one of the mistakes that happened, that, you know, he should have, well, both, right? Both the people on the streets and in the struggle should have stayed mobilized, should have stayed, you know, basically governing with him, and also I think, you know, knowing the type of violence that the right wing in Peru has traditionally used to silence their, you know, political opposition. Of course, I'm not surprised that his family had to seek asylum in Mexico, right? Another reason why AMLO is not necessarily welcome in Peru in this current regime in Peru, is because he's giving asylum to Castillo's family, who I don't think would be safe in the country right now. So it's been quite a struggle to see, you know, just exactly how typically U.S. backed comprador class in Peru will just really truly sell out the country and their land and the people to just appease these foreign interests, right? And of course the major corruption that comes with that, right? Most presidents, ex-presidents in Peru have actually gone, have had corruption cases against them, and if, you know, are serving time if they're not out of the country in exile. So it's been, yeah, it has been really beautiful to see also just exactly how people have been organizing themselves. And then, you know, this isn't just this current iteration of protests. This is very ancestral and very like much tied to what culture, how our cultures govern themselves, right? Before all of this colonization and neo-colonization, current iterations of it.
That is definitely something I want to dig into in a moment, but I appreciate, again, you spelling through all those things, because the agrarian reform, of course, we know the history of Chile and Guatemala, with Salvador Allende and Jacobo Arbenz, two not particularly, say, communist, you know, folks who won through democratic elections, like Castillo, whose, you know, some of their very first policies were the institution of agrarian reform, of nationalization of industries and resources, and also of things like development of regional blocks and trade, development of integration of communities such as the plurinational state that you mentioned that has developed in Bolivia and is still developing. But a couple of things I wanted to hit on, if you'll allow me a second. So you mentioned the fact that this is an ancestral struggle. And of course, we know that Bolivia, Peru, these are two of the few earliest places where Spanish colonialism really solidified itself in the Potosi, in Bolivia, and in the mining places and industries and fields that I'm sure are some of the same still being dug out for what little can be taken from them today. And all in this time, of course, the indigenous peoples have been resisting. Some examples can be seen either in, simply running away, something that I think a lot of folks don't really legitimize or analyze as a huge part of the struggle in many indigenous struggles, but more importantly also the history of not running away, of struggling militantly, of organizing themselves. There are plenty of examples across Latin America, the Caribbean, and also what we call North America, to say that the indigenous peoples that, you know, many museums, many history books segment to ancient history along with dinosaurs and certain fauna and, ecosystems that no longer exist. But indigenous peoples are here today in Peru, in Bolivia, and in many other places struggling and taking power. And that is something that I think, the left really needs to learn from, not only here in the West, but around the world, right? The second thing I wanted to mention is just that there was a recent document I read from the Alliance for Global Justice on the 2023 Human Rights Report of the United States. And in that, it documented through, a collection of articles, statistics, and studies, both nationally and internationally, that the human rights abuses both within and outside of what we call the domestic colonies of the United States or internal colonies of the United States, colonies such as Puerto Rico, such as Hawaii, and other cases could be made to call nations like Haiti a colony of the United States and of Europe and the United Nations. But anyways, I mention this because when we look at the domestic character of what's happening with the police repression against the African People's Socialist Party, the development of what has been coined Cop City, the intensification of struggles on the ground, both in workplaces like the Union of Southern Service Workers, the Democratic Council within the Teamsters Union, and other fronts that, like Starbucks workers, Amazon workers, but also farmers and immigrants and indigenous folks for land rights and water protection. Yeah. The intensification of the repression against all these groups, of course, both reflects, mirrors, intensifies, and advances along with the repression which the United States is enacting around the world. And one tool that they're using, of course, is a little organization known as SOUTHCOM. Some other organizations of mention might be the Organization of American States, as you mentioned earlier. Two wings of the US Imperial Empire, along with USAID, the National Endowment for Democracy. But I mentioned SOUTHCOM because you brought up how U.S. troops have been touching down in the thousands. Of course, we know when actual military, soldiers arrive, so do intelligence agents, so do, quote-unquote, instructors, you know, arms dealers, all kinds of funny little characters in this play called Imperialism. But Southcom, the leader, I can't think of what the fuck her name is.
Richardson.
Say again?
Laura Richardson.
Yes, Laura Richardson.
Yeah.
Laura, not a friend of the show, did an interview where she spoke about, actually, quite plainly, it circled around on Instagram for a bit from Kelsachin News, a little clip of her saying that there are these resources. You mentioned lithium, but bauxite, cobalt, and others are of mention, that nations like Peru, Bolivia, Venezuela, Nicaragua, Chile, Colombia, and many other countries, especially also in, you know, Africa, right? But for them, they got their own organization, AFRICOM. Southcom's leader, Laura Richardson, mentioned how these are things that the U.S. government can't give up strategic interest in. And of course, we know what that means. That's why the troops are touching down, because at the end of the day, no matter how much the United States talks the talk about democracy, freedom, liberty, today is July 4th. We all who have lived in the United States, have friends who live in the United States, have seen what the United States has done for 200 plus years around the world through the Monroe Doctrine and other, you know, actions here on Turtle Island. We know that deep in its core, it's an imperial empire based on exploitation and oppression. So these upcoming mobilizations, right, and this kind of tackling of Lima and the capital where the wealth concentrates and all the roads run to, right? Side note, a good way to know whether or not a nation like Peru has really been given the opportunity to stand on its own legs is to simply look at how most of the roads lead to three locations, usually. One, central cities and hubs. Two, ports. And three, airports. Rural areas, you know, where the majority of the population lives, be damned. Potholes, dirt roads, or, you know, nothing at all, is what the majority of quote-unquote underdeveloped nations, aka overexploited nations, have for themselves. But last thing I want to mention on this little rant is a video that I think is of value for watching. Back when the coup in Venezuela happened to overthrow Chavez and he was captured, there's a video of Nicolas Maduro speaking to a crowd of, I believe, a couple thousand. And when I asked you earlier where Castillo was and whether folks knew, you know, at this time when Maduro was speaking, they had recently found out where Chavez was being held because this information was trying to be, you know, kept a secret. And folks like Fidel Castro actually were speaking with Chavez's daughter to try to get this information out. But Maduro has this speech where he says, you know, we know where Chavez is. We know where he's being held. We know what they're doing to him and what they're trying to do to our country. We are not going to allow it. We demand that he be released, or we will release him ourselves, essentially, right? I'm paraphrasing here. But what it makes me think about is, you know, the strength of what those numbers in Lima and the organizations going all the way back to the most rural corners and tracts of, you know, Peru, what that could look like, right, in a world where Dina Boluarte is outed and ousted, tried and convicted for human rights abuses, that, you know, the people are able to close down and abolish and get rid of the, well, I shouldn't say abolish, but close down the current Congress for its corruption and its open far-right activities, to be able to try, arrest, and convict all those who participated in the collaboration with the coup government and the U.S. You know, what a beautiful sight it would be to be able to see Peru look like what nations like Bolivia, Venezuela, Nicaragua, Cuba, and others are being able to build today. So I guess the reason why I'm painting that pretty picture for us is to ask you, you know, you mentioned earlier that Peru is a very anti-communist nation. This isn't, you know, uncommon. Many of these nations in the global South, as we call it, have had actually militant revolutionary struggles of workers, of campesinos. They've had guerrilla struggles. They've had armed, you know, civil wars. They've had all kinds of coups and military dictatorships, U.S. invasions. And yet so many remain anti-communist, anti-socialist.
Yeah.
Do these ideals appeal at all to folks on the ground? Is there any way you could speak to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that without necessarily naming things, people have said that that's, you know, what they want. Like their main, some of the main demands are nationalizing and industrializing resources. Can't think of anything more in line with those politics, right? They might not say, you know, I'm a socialist or I'm a communist, but these are the profound wants and desires of the people, the mass majority of the people in Peru, you know, and to have whatever profits from those industries go towards public goods, public services, you know, housing, infrastructure, education, healthcare, you know, they see that as really being the only way to actually develop the rest of Peru, not just Lima, right? And not just for the profits of a few transnational, you know, boards, executive boards.
Right, right. And now I have two responses. First is a serious one, and second is an annoying Twitter nerd response, just for the sake of maybe prepping you for what's to come, you know. But, you know, of course, this just makes sense, right? You have a nation which for 500, like, fucking think about that shit, people. 500 years has been incapable not only of governing itself, but even simply having control over its own resources and the profits that come from them, its labor and the products that are developed within the nation or through the nation's resources. That just, you know, you have a nation of mainly rural farming, you know, campesinos, indigenous folks, and a small concentration of wealth and urbanization in capital cities. And this is nothing but like an obvious reminder to people every single day of the exploitation that they're facing. So again, it just makes sense. Now comes my Twitter nerd response, and I actually wrote it in the notes, and I'm glad this is coming up naturally. So actually existing socialism, right? It is a term that's usually used as a pejorative to insult nations around the world by the Western countries, especially today. And of course, I mentioned earlier, but we didn't really discuss in depth, the way in which the left here on Turtle Island and throughout Europe, you know, really protested against or critiqued and criticized the Castillo government. Again, before it even really touched down as a solidified government. So, do folks on the ground there, you know, discuss Westerners' hatred of them, basically, I guess you'd say, and also Do you think this term actually existing socialism has any foundation, or is it just a worthwhile insult for nations who really can't build true socialism?
Yeah, I mean, it's I feel like it's definitely, you know, used as a propagandistic tool to, you know, basically just be negative about countries, especially in Latin America, that are taking their own route and have every right to be a self-governing sovereign nation, like Cuba, like Nicaragua, like Venezuela, right? And use their different organs of imperial power, like the OAS, to launch, you know, ridiculous claims of human rights abuses against, you know, whatever political opposition, and things like that, and you know, try to coup and you know, sanction these countries and try to make them fall in every way possible. So, yeah, I think when people, you know, maybe don't use the terms socialism to describe socialists to describe themselves, it is because they're, you know, they're not trying to get that backlash that it would immediately happen when it's like, oh, well, you're just a Castro lover or whatever, you know, you're just a terrorist. But when people are actually explaining what it is that they want, what it is their communities want, what would make sense for Peru to move forward, I think people can agree with that. You know, I think people, even, you know, I wouldn't say necessarily the, like, you know, bourgeois classes, the upper classes, but certainly I would say, you know, even middle classes, the managerial classes could even just, they can even see, like, yeah, that's, you're not wrong. The southern regions or outer regions are very much exploited. They can understand why, you know, people are out in the streets mourning their, you know, loved ones that were murdered and fighting for a better Peru, a better country for themselves and for their kids and grandkids. And I think, you know, that's probably why there's such a huge disapproval rating for both Boluarte and the Congress. I think the Congress only has like 6% approval rating and Boluarte only maybe like 9 or 8, something like that. So, you know, the country, I guess in that sense is very much in agreement, and there's agreement that this is definitely, you know, it was a coup.
Right. And I put a little message in the chat as you were finishing your thought there. I feel like also in some cases, like,
yeah,
the managerial class also recognizes that they might be able to jockey for higher positions of power that, like, you know, the U.S. imperialists or formerly like the Spanish Empire had taken over, right? In the past and present, to try to like just bump themselves up that much more.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I'm interested to maybe talk about what, you know, the connections between, like, you mentioned you're on the Haiti and America's team with Black Alliance for Peace, shout out BAP. I wanted to hear maybe some of your thoughts about the connections between what's happening in Peru, in Honduras, in Haiti, and other Latin American and Caribbean nations, right? From maybe both perspectives. First of all, like the, you know, popular, maybe in some cases spontaneous, other cases organized, calls for democratic, social democratic, or like even like we're mentioning socialist or socialist adjacent ideologies, projects, policies. And on the other side, you know, the development of repression and maybe why they're facing all these difficulties. And if I can add on to that, sorry here, but if I could ask you maybe somewhere in the middle or wherever it fits to add in maybe, or even at the beginning, where Boluarte and her kind of clique come from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, you know, these countries, whether it's like directly neighboring countries or just in the broader region are all, whether currently or have been in the past, faced some kind of lawfare campaign from the US and the West to try to oust any sort of, you know, any of these even vaguely social democratic parties and ideologies, right? Projects and whatever. So I feel like in that region, right? So I think what could have been what we saw as military dictatorships and just outright US invasions in the past, now we see the use of lawfare, of basically weaponizing, going through regime change by weaponizing the judiciary system in whatever country. And right, so whether these countries have voted in for someone of like leftist or left adjacent politics, usually there's another institution of power that's still, that the right still has influence in, and that tends to be the judiciary powers. Or in Peru's case, that as well as Congress, right? So they're able to, you know, weaponize and use and abuse laws to tie up whatever kind of, you know, reforms these politicians want to make, because they're fulfilling campaign promises and launch, you know, bogus court cases, right? Lava Jato in Brazil that, you know, ousted Rousseff and then Lula, was, you know, a form of lawfare, what we saw in Argentina, or where we are seeing in Argentina with Cristina Kirchner, has also been another form of lawfare. I mean, you know, even Correa can't go back to Ecuador because, you know, that they're still, that lawfare campaign is still, still would affect him, right? So we see that this is like a new form of US and Western interference in the region to, you know, to continue that what now, I think in December, will be 200 years of the Monroe Doctrine, right? So I think that some of these, the countries that you mentioned, a lot of that, a lot of what they're, you know, what facing difficulties has been because of, right, the blowback, what ends up being people democratically electing these governments, and then the blowback from US and Western imperialism. And so there's been, you know, it's been a struggle in the region, and it continues to be a struggle. But yeah, I mean, at least in the case of Peru, this has been about 7 months of continual mobilization, right? And maybe not as many as in the very beginning, but, you know, organizing towards having those mass mobilizations again, and continuing to organize on the regional level, on a local level, on a macro regional level, and nationally, to overturn this. You know, a lot of times what I am reminded of, right, it's like it took Bolivia a year to overturn the Áñez regime. You know, it takes time. And very unfortunately, a lot of life lost, and, you know, injuries and just a bunch of, you know, political repression, things like this. But the people are steadfast, right? The people are organized, and they know that, you know, it's just a matter of time.
Well, and I'll say two things on that really quick. One, you never really fully let your enemy know all of your moves and all your cards. So although mass mobilizations might have slowed down, or at least, you know, in number aren't as many, the size has continued to, as far as I've seen, either stay steady or in some cases grow. And as well, you know, we don't know everything that is being organized there on the ground. There's many groups, you know, at play here. And so, like you said, it took Bolivia a year, but they did it. And the people of Peru will succeed as well. I did want to also mention real quick here that, you know, you mentioned earlier that Evo Morales is blamed as having possibly been a supporter or, you know, the funder of these mobilizations, right? And I just wanted to bring up here that the insane amount of wealth that goes into not only developing the far right and oppositional organizations, militia groups, you know, community groups, if you can call them that, religious extremist groups who take part in these coup actions, military dictatorships around the world, that in and of itself should blow our minds. But then when you think about these types of governments have existed like either simultaneously or consecutively around the world, not just in Peru, but these occupation governments, these dictatorships, and now these lawfare type of organizations, which similarly to what the U.S. has built here within its own domestic internal colonies with the Supreme Court and with its so-called democratic system, that's what they use as far as a jumping off point and foundation to develop these types of advanced judicial, not just simply obstacles, but, you know, in some cases, death sentences. And you mentioned the insane amount of life lost in Bolivia. And of course, you know, all our hearts have to go out to the families and the friends and the comrades of those lost in Bolivia. But what I wanted to mention here is we know that Evo Morales is not a terrorist. We know that the MAS is not an armed militia. We know that also Bolivia and the amount of wealth that has been stolen from it would not feasibly be able to do anything of the sort. But the countries who can and do, like the United States, use this propaganda tool and introduce these propaganda tools to the coup governments that they instruct from Washington or from wherever, and take not only the trillions of dollars stolen from the global south, but of course also, you know, the life, the labor, the wealth, and the, in some cases, you know, actual existence of folks in the internal colonies of the United States, because folks from all the different sectors of this empire are either, you know, forced into, coerced, or essentially drafted into being the colonial troopers for the United States. So there's so many lives being hurt throughout this process. And yet, so many here and so many around the world are silent in these moments or spend more time criticizing what could have been or what should have happened in order to stop this from, you know, what I'm sitting in right now, an armchair, while the people of these nations, these revolutionary nations, these, you know, real militant struggles are actually in the streets organizing. And I wanted to maybe head towards our conclusion here by asking you, why do you think the world doesn't care about Peru and Latin America?
Well, I think much like any of the propaganda that we have consumed throughout our lives is that, you know, the global South, and maybe not just Latin America, right, but broader, the global South is just those people over there, you know, that's just, poverty is just natural in that area, right? Like there seems to be this just like, oh yeah, that's just how it is there. And so people just kind of hear that there's uprisings, but don't, you know, maybe for a couple of days or weeks, we'll see things in the news and then it goes away, right? And it just becomes like another thing, whether and we didn't really see that with this coup and this uprising. I didn't really, you know, I didn't see any SOS campaigns, SOS Peru campaigns, like we did with Iran or, you know, Cuba, right? So I think that's also another thing is, you know, mainstream Western media is not going to tell you exactly, you know, what's happening in the global South. And if they do, it'll be like for a day or something. And it's so it's not, you know, it's definitely not something that that is on people's minds typically. And yeah, I think a lot of that is obviously just the racism that we see the global South through, you know, it's just those people over there, and that's how it is. It's just poverty is natural to those areas. But I, you know, hopefully we begin to see changes in that, because this is a very, you know, dignified, noble struggle. And, you know, hopefully if people can't have some sort of empathy for that, understanding that it's also your military that's being sent there, and it's your tax money that's supporting these things, right? That's supporting and supplying the Peruvian armed forces with, you know, military wartime weaponry to use against a completely weaponless population that is going, you know, with their flags, their wifalas, and you know, megaphones, that they're, you know, just ramming down and brutally repressing. So I hope that, yeah, more people start, you know, start to ask questions, what's happening, you know, what, like, why are people out there, and supporting however they can, right? Whether it's, you know, sharing stories or, you know, staying up to date. I think it's important, especially for those of us that are in the US, in the belly of the beast, to be aware about what's going on. And also, yeah, to, you know, ideally jump into action and organize in your neighborhoods. You know, I know people, especially Peruvians in the diaspora, have been doing a lot of organizing a lot of solidarity actions on different days. And I think actually we'll also be seeing from in different cities around the world, solidarity actions with the third takeover of Lima, that'll be July 19th. I know New York, they're gonna have an event at the Peruvian consulate. I'm sure other, you know, probably in Washington, D.C. and other places throughout the country and throughout internationally, we'll be having events as well. Yeah, so it's hopefully it's just a matter of, you know, plugging in wherever you are at and supporting the struggle.
Beautifully said. And, you know, a couple things before we close out. First of all, you know, you mentioned how racism really is intrinsic to why so much of the global South is simply viewed as other, as, you know, the impoverished nations, as the global South, rather than, you know, a collection of nations, of people who have their own history, right, and have their own things to give to the world, which they have and do every day, such as these struggles against fascism, against neoliberalism, against colonialism, and against imperialism. The second thing I wanted to mention is just that, along on that, racism really tends to be, you know, commonly misunderstood. Of course, we know this, and misrepresented intentionally. But the best way that I have come to learn about really how racism manifests, I learned through the Black Liberation Army's first volume that came out from Rookery Press, the collected works of the, I believe it was the Central Committee that put together most of those, the Black Liberation Army Central Committee. and in that they mentioned that, well, of course, racism is a systematic, structural, material thing that has foundation first in the real world before justifications like the fact that, oh, these people aren't human, or these people aren't Christian, or these people come from Africa, or these people come from Latin America or the Caribbean, right? They're in, you know, assuming they deserve it. And, you know, on top of that, it also manifests itself as an intrinsic inability to understand the reality in front of us. Because similarly to lacking objective information or working primarily from an opportunistic or individualistic stance, one's incapable of actually understanding what's happening in front of them because they're thinking through a lens which is not based in reality, at least to say that it doesn't have grounds to be based in reality, but that has been developed over time to cultivate an army of collaborators among the European population, what we call the white population. And because of this, there is much, you know, sadness to be said about the history of organizing both here on Turtle Island and around the world. And something I wanted to mention here is, you know, we can spend all the time we want discussing, debating, you know, going over and analyzing this history. It is important to study. But we get to decide today, right along with the people of Peru and the diaspora, right along with the people of Africa and of the global south and of the working class and oppressed people around the world, we get to decide what our movement looks like, what our socialism looks like, what our struggles look like. And so if today you're sitting there thinking, shit, you know, I fucking hate this country wherever you're at, or I hate, you know, this life, you're feeling apathetic, you're feeling depressed, you're feeling like, you know, real doomerish, as we call it, I would really suggest looking into either, you know, national organizations like, you know, two have mentioned. One, the first we both belong to, the Black Alliance for Peace and the Black Alliance for Peace Solidarity Network. There's many committees that can be joined. Also, I'm a member of the Spirit of Mandela and About the People, which is doing, it's one of the committees of Spirit of Mandela. We're doing, you know, coverage of political prisoners through audio and visual features that have, you know, a lot of great information in them, but also groups like the Nicaragua Solidarity Coalition, Community Movement Builders. There's many worth mentioning, the African People's Socialist Party or the Uhuru Solidarity Movement. But more importantly, you know, if you can't do that, or if it's not practical for you to do that, or you have, you know, some idea that you gotta have ideological complete unison with whatever organization you join, well, then take a couple people in your block, from your work, from your school, from your friend group, and start talking about some of these problems. And start talking about maybe, hey, what could we do as the 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 of us, right? To maybe get 2 more or 10 more. What can we do then to actually make moves, right? And actually maybe try it and see what comes out, right? Because I think more than anything, what the struggle across the world, the international struggle that's happening in places like Kenya, in places like so-called Swaziland, in places like Peru, in places like Venezuela, in places like Iran, right? These types of struggles, whether they happen to fall under our perfect, pure, you know, idea of Western, you know, anyways, you know, whether it comes under what we call socialism or not, the most important thing that we see here is militancy and a dedication to struggle that, I'll tell you what, in my own experience, I would love to see more of. So, you know, help us be a part of that. What say you there, my friend?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, at the end of the day, it's always, you know, join an organization. We got to organize ourselves. The war, class war, we're already in it, you know. So might as well actually join and arm yourselves, you know, study. and yeah, move coordinated fashion, in a coordinated fashion, with an organization that is fighting for national liberation, for, you know, African liberation, what have you. People that are on the ground and moving, definitely. Would agree with that.
Well, my friend, this has been a blessing and a real honor. So please, you know, let us know how folks can support you, maybe close this out with any final thoughts or statements you wanted to say on behalf of the people of Peru or yourself or whatever organizations you belong to.
Absolutely. No, thank you so much for having me and for this conversation. It's been a lot of fun. Getting to tell people about what's been happening on the ground. So ways to support, I would say, if you want to read my work on Black Agenda Report, you could find out a little bit more about, you know, what's been happening, different parts of the struggle, of the organizing, what the state is doing. And also, right now, I'm currently, one of the organizations that I've been supporting on the ground is the Consejo por la Emancipación Plurinacional del Perú. And we're fundraising for, actually to get delegates to Lima for July 19th, but also in the lead up to that, to different areas to do press conferences and things like this. So if you, you can follow me at either on Instagram or Facebook. And my name on Instagram for both of them is Michi Sarchipapas. and if you would, ideally, if you can donate or share, this call for donations, it's on my Instagram. But also you can donate to directly to paypal.me/ClaudiaO'Brien35. And yeah, I'm sending donations back to my comrades there so that they can organize a delegation, you know, cover travel expenses and do press conferences and political education in the lead up to that.
That's awesome. Thank you so much, my friend. You know, one thing before we close, you know, free Pedro Castillo, all power to the people of Peru. Fuck Dina Boluarte, you know, fucking people in the United States need to recognize the role that we're playing in this death sentence for these folks and start moving on that.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Yes, and free all political prisoners here in Peru.